This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Fred Bever, in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Another step forward for medical marijuana in New Hampshire as the state approves three companies to build dispensaries. State regulator John Martin warns, however, that there are still hoops to jump through before the dispensaries are up and running.
We're hoping that the municipalities will work collaboratively with the alternative treatment centers and will embrace them. But bottom line is they do have to have local approval. If they can't get it, then they'll need to look at another jurisdiction.
The state Supreme Court rules that Keene's meter-feeding Robinhooders can continue their parking meter campaign. The protesters' attorney said that the decision is a win for free speech.
The opinion speaks in very strong terms about the fact their expression was protected, whether you agree with them or not, and that you can't then, you know, you can't sort of basically intimidate demonstrators by suing them for damages.
And primary politics continue to gain momentum with debates over debates, a big turnout for Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders, visits from GOP hopefuls Chris Christie and Carly Fiorina. Fiorina says the welfare state creates barriers to success in America.
Tangle them up in these programs of dependence, and instead of asking them to move forward with their lives, we discourage them from doing so.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I am Fred Bever, sitting in for Laura Kanoy. Let us hear from you. Call in. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Get your pencil. It's 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Now, our guests today are Kathleen Ronayne. She's the New Hampshire State House and politics reporter for the Associated Press. Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
Trent Spinner, executive editor of the New Hampshire Union Leader. Welcome, Trent.
Hey, Fred.
And Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University and author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. For early summer or late spring, there's certainly plenty going on here in the Granite State. Right now, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, I want to put you on the spot. There's been a flurry of action over the last several days about an early August debate for the GOP primary candidates. Fox News had come up with its own sort of criteria, and then the Union Leader weighed in. Set this up for us and tell us what the latest is.
Sure. Let's start with some background, which is that last cycle, the Republicans said there were way too many debates. There were days where Republican candidates were debating one night and then having another debate the next morning. And so Concord's own Steve Dupree, who is a member of the RNC, worked with other members of the RNC to sort of sketch out a plan that would limit the number of debates but still give voters access to those candidates and let them hear it out. So what happened was Fox News got the first debate, which was coming up in Cleveland, Ohio in August, which everyone was okay with. But then what happened was Fox News executives started saying that what we're going to do with this debate is try to winnow the field. Fox News is going to winnow the field before Iowa, before New Hampshire gets their shot at doing that. And New Hampshire Republicans were very upset. So on 2 days ago, we were sitting in my office talking about this. And as we were talking about what the Union Leader could do to fill a hole, right? We provide news coverage. And we were talking about how this Fox News debate was going to leave a hole for candidates who weren't in the top 10. And so we said, you know what, we're going to do the New Hampshire thing, and we're going to provide that news coverage that Fox News is not going to do. And we were talking about how to do it. And at that exact moment, we were sitting in my office, this email came through from Jamie Burnett, also from Concord, who got dozens of high-profile Republicans in the state to say, we would like Fox News to change their criteria. The criteria, as it is now, is the top 10 candidates in five national polls, the average of five national polls. So we said, that's just not going to work. That's not the New Hampshire way. So what we said was, we're going to start our own – we're going to have a forum that very same day, and we're going to invite all the candidates who – not just excluded candidates. We're going to invite all the candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be somebody who was – maybe a candidate who was invited to the Fox debate but they might think that spending time in New Hampshire would be more worthwhile to them. So about 3 hours after we announced that, Fox News announced their own forum earlier in the day. And we're
a second forum for what they considered second-tier candidates,
exactly.
Judging by the polls.
Exactly.
Okay.
But it's still unclear what that forum is going to look like. So until we see what that forum is going to look like, we are still planning to host our own forum and provide that coverage. Look, we're in New Hampshire, right? Our job is to make sure that people get to hear from these candidates, whether they're or not they're in the top 10 of a national poll.
I had seen one suggestion that primary voters in New Hampshire would actually – there'd be a backlash against candidates who attended a Fox debate rather than a union leader forum. Dean, what do you make of that? Who are the potential winners and losers here?
Well, you know, it's interesting watching this turn into such a huge issue, both for the campaigns and also for the media. You know, I think CNN has the second debate, and they're going to have two sessions. I think they're going to have the so-called B team first, and then the A team second, or whatever term you want to use. You know, the easiest way to solve this problem would be for these networks to, do two debates if there are roughly 16 candidates, have 2 8-person debates. And just randomize it. It would solve the whole problem. There's just a lot of unknowns here. It's sort of unknown what the backlash really would be. You know, we're talking about a backlash. I have sort of mixed feelings about whether or not Fox really would be able to winnow the field. There's sort of varying mm-hmm. opinions among observers about just how important it is to be in that first tier. Some people say it's do or die. Others say, probably not in the long run. I think I'm leaning a little towards the second camp. I think there's a danger of kind of overemphasizing the impact of a single debate. The other concern, with all due respect to the union leader, is these candidates are making a choice between being on Fox News or being on C-SPAN, I believe would be the outlet for the union leader forum.
It would be nationally.
Yeah, it would be national, but it would be C-SPAN. It would not be Fox News. So, I mean, those campaigns have to kind of weigh that sort of exposure issue as well. But I think it's certainly a nice idea, but it's kind of symptomatic of the decentralized nature of the selection process. You know, whether it's debates or front-loading of the primary schedule, it's very hard for a national party or an individual media outlet to try to sort of enforce order into the process as they see most appropriate without some kind of a backlash or controversy, and it's exactly what we're seeing right now.
Trent Spinner, is it correct that some people feel that actually the importance of the New Hampshire primary could be at stake here, that if Fox were to, although Dean Spiliotis is
right,
skeptical,
yes.
That if Fox were to actually winnow the field, that New Hampshire could lose some of its prominence in the process.
And that's 100% the reason we have announced this forum, is because New Hampshire's role in the process has always been to take the time to help candidates get their message to voters. And the voters, the residents here in New Hampshire, understand how to talk to candidates and really do devote a lot of time to making sure they ask the right questions. This Fox debate, maybe it's going to be 90 minutes, and if there are 10 people on stage, each person may get 2 or 3 minutes. So to decide who the next president may or may not be with 2 or 3 minutes of sound bites just is not
– Trent, you really think that's what will happen as a result of this Fox debate? This gets at what you're saying about whether or not it's going to have a decisive impact. I mean, are you in that camp of this would be disastrous for
– It's not
campaigns?
So much that I'm – I mean, I don't – I'm undecided. But if you talk to candidates like Carly Fiorina, we talked to her in an editorial meeting a couple weeks ago about this, and she says, for my campaign to continue, this is incredibly important. She says this is – of all the goals that I've set for myself, this is the number one goal right now, is to get into this Fox debate, because it's going to be so critical for me. So will they have to drop out if they don't get into the Fox debate in August? Probably not, but it certainly won't help.
Do you have a sense that any of the candidates who are doing better in the polls are throwing their weight around and saying, hey, keep these little guys away from us?
I think there's certainly no benefit for somebody like a Jeb Bush to be on stage next to a Carly Fiorina or a John Kasich. There's no net benefit for him. So I don't know if they're throwing their weight around behind the scenes, but they certainly are. I would imagine they'd have their fingers crossed that this works out.
Okay, so more to come. We'll see eventually what Fox's real criteria are for the secondary forum, and then hopefully we'll get to see what the Union Leaders Forum criteria are as well, because then, of course, there becomes a new debate about exactly what the formats are. So Kathleen Ronayne, I want to bring you in here now to tell us a little bit about the latest from the State House. You've been covering the bouncing ball of the state budget, roughly $11 billion at stake. Agreement now amongst Republican leaders? Where's it headed?
Well, today is going to be the first committee of conference meeting. So that's when House and Senate negotiators come together. They start talking about what they want this budget to look like. There's about a little bit more than $100 million difference between what the House passed and what the Senate passed. It's going to be interesting to see if there's much disagreement between those two chambers. You know, the Senate has the benefit of extra revenue estimates down the line, so they were able to put back a lot of the cuts that the House made. So I'm really fascinated to see if the House is going to come in with a position of their own and stake something out and say, we don't like what's in your budget, Senate, and we want this and that, because they first need to find agreement on a plan that they can come together and bring to the governor. And there are two Democrats on the negotiating committee, so we've got five House members, four senators, just two Democrats, Mary Jane Wallner from Concord and Lou D'Alessandro from Manchester. But, you know, they do need to talk with Democrats a little bit, because ultimately the governor does have the option of vetoing this budget, signing it, or she can let it pass without her signature. We've seen all of those things happen within the past decade or so. You know, Craig Benson vetoed the budget when he was governor. Governor Lynch let the so-called O'Brien budget pass without his signature. So we're definitely a long ways away from seeing what this final product is going to look like, because the governor wants a lot of things that she's going to be trying to push Republicans on.
What are those things besides Keno?
I think, you know, she really wants Medicaid expansion, which I can say with 99.9% certainty is not going to be included in the budget, but she's going to continue to fight for it. She wants the budget to honor the pre-negotiated state employees contract. They're supposed to get 2% raises, and that's not in the budget right now. So those are two big things that she's going to be looking for.
We'll talk a little bit more about the budget, words about government shutdown and veto in the air when we come back to The Exchange. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. When we come back, we'll be talking about the budget. We'll be talking about the Free Keene movement and the Alton Selectmen when they took action to boot someone they didn't like out of a meeting. Be right back. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Fred Bever, in for Laura Kanoy. We're covering some of the top stories of the week, from free speech to turmoil in the GOP. And maybe we'll get to a look at Congressman Frank Ginta's tenure later in the show. Please join us with your thoughts. Call in. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Now, I'm here with Kathleen Ronayne. She's the New Hampshire State House and politics reporter for the Associated Press. Trent Spinner, executive editor of the New Hampshire Union Leader. And Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University. And he's the author of the website, nhpoliticalcapital.com. Now, when we left for the break, we were talking about the budget. I want to continue along there a little bit. It's not just about numbers and horse trading. It's also about politics, it seems. And there have been some balloons floating around the state this week with the words government shutdown or gubernatorial veto on them. Trent Spinner, what's going on?
So the Republican Party of New Hampshire put out a press release and created this image on their website saying that there are about 20 days left before the government potentially shuts down. But both House and Senate leadership, Republican leaders say, you know, that's not true. What's happening behind the scene is there are continuing resolutions that are being put together that would essentially keep all the current budget funding in place for as long as they would need before they pass a budget. And yes, the governor has said there's a potential for me to veto a budget. The word veto has come up, but I'm not sure that that is a serious possibility at this point.
Kathleen, does this rhetoric affect what's going on in the State House? I think Chris Sununu's name has been attached to some of it. How do the dynamics work once you're down in the dome?
You know, I mean, it's just politics. That's really all it is. Mm-hmm. I think it's personally fascinating to me that, you know, the New Hampshire Republican Party comes out with this idea of the government shutdown, and who have to be the ones to come out and say, whoa, hold your horses, Republican leadership. So you have to imagine that Sean Jasper and Chuck Morse were probably not happy that they had to come out and say, mm-hmm. you know, there's not going to be a government shutdown here. So I think that was particularly interesting. But, you know, I think that this is just politics. This is what happens in budget season. We saw Governor Hassan in the 2014 election talk a lot about this great bipartisan budget that, you know, is her number one accomplishment. At this time in the budget process last time, it was all along partisan lines. She was calling Republicans irresponsible. The Senate comes together and passes a budget 24-0. I'm not saying that's what's going to happen this time. I think 2016 is on everybody's minds. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows if Governor Hassan's running for Senate. No one knows if she's running for governor again. I mean, I think everybody's kind of thinking about the future here, and politics are certainly on everyone's minds. But this is a process. It gets highly political at this time. They're going to be negotiating back and forth. You know, it's unclear to me if they are going to be able to find compromise on certain things, like the state employees contract. That's something that hasn't come up. Maybe that is something that will be used as a negotiating chip. You know, she doesn't like the business tax cuts. She doesn't like the mental health or substance abuse funding. These are all things that they're going to continue to talk about. Because I think that, you know, if you do get to that level of a veto, and I think why there's all this talk of a veto is there are Democrats walking around the State House telling reporters and others, hey, I'm hearing the governor's going to veto this. I don't know if that's a sanctioned message from the governor they're putting out, but they're coming down to the press room and saying it. And we had, you know, the Senate Democratic leader on the floor say we're on the brink of a veto on the Senate floor. And it's, you know, interesting that he's putting out that message. So this is not, you know, all Republicans kind of creating this talk. The Democrats are certainly doing it as well. But that's risky for everybody. I mean, if she vetoes a budget, it's I don't know who wins that messaging war. I don't know who comes out looking better. So you've got to think that they're all making these calculations about what they want to see. Is it better for them to find a budget that she signs? Is it better for them to get a budget that she vetoes? There are a lot of different scenarios here, and it's all going to play out over the next couple weeks.
So some bluffing, some real poker playing going on.
Yes, definitely.
I'm not quite sure what they're holding in each hand.
Definitely.
Now, there are some more substantive veto threats out there. Can any of you tell us a little bit about, first of all, the 30-day residency requirement that's passed the legislature for voting in the state of New Hampshire? Is that real? Is that political? Dean Spiliotis, you look like you.
Well, I think Governor Hassan is likely to veto that. It's not particularly popular among Democrats. This is an issue that's been in the courts. There's when you register to vote, there's a lot of confusion about the relationship between your domicile and your residence. And so the lack of clarity in the language has been a problem in previous attempts at this. You know, the Democrats argue that this is bad for having this 30-day requirement is bad for, you know, people in the military, students, medical residents who move around, et cetera. And it's just not in keeping with the idea of maximizing political participation. You know, there is this larger debate in the country about voter fraud. Republicans argue that there's a fair bit of potential for voter fraud or voter fraud, and Democrats say that's not the case. It's just anecdotal. And a lot of these, I think there are 30 states that have these kinds of residency things. And in fairness, Bill Gardner, our Secretary of State, has said, you know, voter fraud is not a huge problem here, but it might be a good idea to have something like this in place. But I think, you know, given my sense of where Democrats are in this and what Governor Hassan has said, I think she'll veto it.
Kathleen Renning.
Yeah, there's also there's a constitutional argument that Democrats are making here. As Dean mentioned, a lot of other states do have these residency requirements, but there's only one other state that has the requirement and allows same-day voting.
Right.
So usually the justification for or same-day registration. Usually the justification for having a residency requirement is that you have to register to vote early. So if you don't live in the state, you can't register to vote. They can't process all your paperwork. But when you can show up on election day and register to vote, it takes away the administrative need to have the residency requirement. And that's we've seen that argument play out in Maine. They have same-day voter registration. And like decades ago, the Maine State Supreme Court said that there was no compelling state interest for them to have 30-day residency requirement. This is something that's been litigated in the Supreme Court. So it's not just a political argument. Democrats actually do feel they have really strong constitutional footing to stand on to say that we don't think this would pass the test in the courts.
It's an issue that does come up perennially in various state houses around the country. And one thing I've noticed is that and Republicans who I've spoken to have been pushing these kinds of measures. They're really they really are pretty annoyed about the college campuses. They feel like it's a vote field that the Democrats can mine, even though these are just students who are transients. Is that part of what's going on here in New Hampshire?
I'll tell you this. I was a college student when I first voted, and I voted here in New Hampshire. I voted in Ringe. And I'll tell you, it was a pretty incredible process because outside there were all kinds of people trying to discourage me from voting. They were saying, be careful. If you vote here, you may lose your scholarship money. You have to change your residency. You may get arrested because if you don't have New Hampshire license plate. I mean, they were trying to make up all these different reasons for why I shouldn't vote outside. And there were attorneys who were standing there saying, no, like that one point that they're saying is incorrect. And so you're standing there. I was 18, voting for the first time, trying to figure out, am I allowed to do this? Can I go inside and vote right now? So there is a lot of confusion, and it is a problem. And you have, on the one hand, you have Democrat Bill Gardner, the Secretary of State, who runs the voting process, saying, we have drive-by voting in New Hampshire. And then on the other hand, you have people who say, if you're in the military, if you're a medical resident, if you're you leave your state and you come to New Hampshire, and in the 30 days between when you left and there's an election, you're legally not allowed to vote. So how's that? You have a constitutional right to do that.
Yeah, you know, Fred, this has been going on forever. I remember being in college and voting over 30 years ago now, and there were the same kinds of things where campaigns were challenging the right of certain students to vote in various jurisdictions. The difference now is with social media and the web, there's this sort of much bigger echo chamber for claims of voter fraud and sort of the marshaling of opinion that this is something that needs to be done. But the college student issue has been a perennial issue going back decades.
And Kathleen, just quickly, how do the numbers look? Is this a sustainable or an overridable veto that would come?
No, because there's no way the Senate would vote to override that veto. So you would need 2/3 votes, and there's not a single. So they have 10. The Republicans would need to pick up 2 Democrats on anything to override a veto, and that would not happen on this bill.
So if she were to veto, she does get her veto.
I believe so. I mean, barring any really crazy circumstance, yes. And the other thing that she's also likely to veto is the so-called constitutional carry, the bill that takes away the licensing requirement for carrying a concealed gun. She's made clear that she plans to veto that. That's another thing that I don't think they have the votes to override definitely in the Senate. So we could see that either of those vetoes come down at any point right now.
Very interesting and potentially to play into the 2016 ambitions.
Yes, yes.
That's a good point. But as we turn away from the State House into some other issues, I want to mention that over the next few weeks, NHPR is producing a series of stories on the state budget and its impact on New Hampshire residents. The series began today with a piece on proposed business tax cuts, and it'll continue next week and beyond as the legislature continues to negotiate around the new budget. So be sure to listen in for that. So from, you know, the freedom to vote within 30 days to the freedom to take a selfie of your votes. That came up in a federal district court in Laconia, I believe, this week. There's a debate over whether one should be allowed to do that. Trent Spinner, haven't been following that?
Well, this is broadly speaking, this is the issue where people like to, after they vote, take pictures of their ballot and put them up on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook. And it goes back to laws, go way back you know, like 100 years or something to voter intimidation laws. And so that's the genesis of it. And the idea is that it's not really sort of as relevant now as it was back at the time that they put these regulations in place. So, you know, I don't recall the exact court decision, but it sounds like the sort of pro-selfie contingent actually has on some good constitutional grounds here in terms of, freedom of expression, freedom of speech, and the right to do that.
Kathleen Ronayne.
Yeah, so we haven't seen an actual court decision on this yet.
Right.
There were just arguments in the court before a federal judge. And it's really this whole idea of, being able to express, your freedom of speech, who you voted for. And I think on the other side, the arguments are kind of that this could be a way to put pressure on how people vote. You know, if your boss like posts on their Facebook how they're voting and they kind of threaten that like you need to do it too. And I don't know that. I don't know if those situations exist, and it sounds like, I wasn't there for the court arguments, but it sounds like the judge was kind of a little skeptical that this was a really like a necessary safeguard for people to say that you can't post your ballots on social media. And it's been getting some traction at the state house because there have been some state representatives who in the last election were posting photos. They were kind of, defying the law and saying we think that this tramples on people's free speech rights. So I think it's, just another interesting thing that comes up with voting and social media. And people, one of the arguments is if people want to show that they voted and they participated in the process, why would we want to be stopping that? And people, you can't bar somebody from telling you who they voted for. It's not like someone can come over to me and say that I can't express my vote to you or that my boss can't express his vote to
me.
That
would be
so
the same kind of
it's,
pressure.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting to see that when it comes to a photo, it's a different rule. So we'll see what happens with that
decision.
Can you
imagine trying to enforce it if people really got their backs up about it? Trent Spinner.
The original intent of the law was to prevent people from being pressured into showing either their boss or a union or whoever.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so now free speech. There was a decision on a free speech or what could be characterized as a free speech issue concerned the so-called Free Keen movement, the Robin Hooders who will go and feed your meter if you're running out of time, just as the meter reader is coming along. And to tell us a little bit about the development of that story and how it appears to be, well, not finishing, but moved to a new phase, is Martha Shanahan of the Keen Sentinel. Martha, please join us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, so first of all, what do these people do? And what did the judge tell them they can or can't do?
Yeah, so the six people that were named in this case, like you said, they're known as Robin Hooders, as in stealing from the rich and giving to the poor. And in 2013, when this case started, there would be four or five of them at a time. Basically, their goal was to save people from getting parking tickets by following the meter maids or the parking enforcement officers and trying to beat them to the expired meters and put coins in before they could give out tickets. They've actually saved me a couple of times. They leave a little card on your car with a picture of the cartoon Robin Hood from the Disney movie that says, "We saved you from the King's Tariff." The city brought a case against them in 2013 looking for injunctions, sort of like a 20 or 50 foot buffer zone, to keep them away from the parking officers because some of them had also been seen yelling at and insulting the parking officers, saying things like, "Everyone hates you, you should quit your job." So that's how this whole thing got started.
So they could be sort of harassing?
Yeah, there's a few videos of them saying some pretty nasty things, and the officers were pretty shaken up about the whole thing. One of them actually quit his job a little while ago because he said that being followed all day and yelled at was too stressful.
And so now it came to court this week, and there was a decision.
Yeah. So earlier this week, there was an appeal in the Supreme Court because a judge here in Keene had initially denied these injunctions against the Robin Hooders, and so that the city appealed that to the Supreme Court, and the court basically ruled that while what these people do, the Robin Hooding, is protected as free speech under the First Amendment. He basically said that the judge would have to go back and make a decision because he hadn't necessarily considered all of the facts and all of the effects that this behavior was having on the meter maids.
There was also talk about going back to the court and trying that the city might try to create a buffer zone.
Yeah, exactly. So they're sort of looking for, and the distance has changed as this case has gone on, but they're basically looking for about a 20 or 15 foot sort of zone that the kind of a restraining order against these six people to protect the park enforcement officers from the harassment that they said was happening and from the stress it was causing them.
Well, that sounds reminiscent, actually, of the U.S. Supreme Court decision regarding Massachusetts abortion clinic buffer zone law, which that court struck down. And New Hampshire is now, I believe, following in the steps of Massachusetts to undo some of its buffer zone requirements there. Is there some resonance here? We're talking about speech. We're talking about, verbal communications. I'm not getting any takers here. Please go ahead.
That actually came up in oral arguments in the New Hampshire Supreme Court in October. The lawyer for the city of Keene hired had argued that some of the language that the U.S. Supreme Court used when they made their decision in that abortion clinic case sort of gave the city the right to take out injunctions against individual people if they were worried about the safety of city employees. So that did come up. That was something that the city was arguing in court. The Supreme Court didn't mention that in their decision. They sort of ignored that. They mostly pointed to a few other cases that set a precedent for this kind of thing being protected under free speech. But it's a bit of a technicality that they're letting the judge in Keene.
Okay, bottom line, very quickly, what's the motivation of these free Keeners? They just want to be good Samaritans and help people out with their parking fees?
Yeah, well, if you ask them, they say that they want to protect people from getting parking tickets. And that they're sort of known for doing things like this, like feeding the meters or filming police officers, anything that sort of pushes up against the authority of the local or state government.
Thanks very much, Martha Shanahan. We've got to go to our break. This is the New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. And this is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR's The Exchange. I'm Fred Bever, sitting in for Laura Knoy. I'm joined in the studio by Kathleen Ronayne, the New Hampshire State House and Politics reporter for the Associated Press, Trent Spinner, executive editor of the New Hampshire Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, and he's the author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Also want to thank Martha Shanahan of the Keene Sentinel, who just filled us in on free speech and free Keeners and Robin Hooders in Keene. There was another free speech issue on the table this week and another judicial decision. This had to do with a gentleman who wanted to go in and tell his selectman off. Trent Spinner, what happened?
This was an incredible story to tell, and especially because it was caught on video. The selectmen in Alton open a public hearing before every meeting, and they give residents, anyone who's on the list, give them 5 minutes to come up and talk to them about whatever they want to say. So Jeff Clay, who has done this before a couple of times to complain about selectmen, got up there and just a couple seconds into his talk starts saying that all the selectmen should resign and they're an embarrassment. And one of the selectmen says, this is a character attack. Stands up from the table, walks out and gets the police chief who, while this public session is still going on, he still has his 5 minutes, orders Mr. Clay to leave, eventually leads him out of the room and arrests him. For I think it was of violating a police order or something like that. There was a ton of attention on this case. People said that this guy doesn't matter what he's saying during this 5 minute public hearing. He's allowed to say it, and selectmen can't just turn him off because they feel like they've been attacked. And a judge agreed with him. A judge said this is pure censorship. He has a First Amendment right to talk about this, and that the selectmen and the police broke not only the New Hampshire Constitution but the United States Constitution.
It was a strongly worded opinion from the judge, who in the past has also made a sort of related ruling in a Guilford situation where someone wanted to speak to town government and was shut off. Is this going to go any further? Will the selectmen of Alton try to fight back, or is this going
to
be it?
We've reached out to the police chief, the town's attorney, the selectmen, and we're not hearing anything back from them. The New Hampshire Civil Liberties Union says, look at this ruling. This is one of the most powerful rulings protecting the First Amendment that we've seen in a very long time.
Dean, do you see it as in keeping with the New Hampshire traditions? How often do selectmen have to deal with someone who's kind of annoying but really does have the right?
It's actually not that unusual, and it's interesting. You know, I watched the video. It's oddly entertaining for people who are interested in seeing kind of public conflict between citizens and their select men and women. But there's clearly, you know, it seems like you can just sort of tell. I don't know the backstory in Alton, but there's clearly a history of some bad blood there. The gentleman sits down. He starts his own stopwatch because he doesn't trust the selectmen to give him his full 5 minutes, and basically just keeps saying that they're bad decision makers, they're poor decision makers. He's disappointed every time he shows up that they haven't resigned. They need to stand up and resign. But there's not – I mean, and one of the selectmen starts talking about slander and character assassination. You know, it's a pretty mild diatribe as these diatribes go, but he just kind of keeps at it even after the policeman asks him to stop. So I'm not surprised to see the court say that this was – I think they use the phrase content-based censorship. Mm-hmm. Basically, he was charged with disorderly conduct. But very interesting. And this stuff does happen periodically. But, you know, I didn't see anything in his presentation there that was, you know, really out of bounds, or he didn't get violent or aggressive or anything. He just kept telling them they were bad decision makers and they should resign.
Kathleen Ronayne?
Yeah, I think it's just important to remember also that it's really, really difficult to be charged with, you know, slander or libel or anything like that when you're speaking about a public figure. And if you are the selectman in your town, you are a public figure. So it's really – I mean, it's not often that you're going to see cases where someone is going to say that, you know, the person speaking does not have the First Amendment right to say whatever they want to say to someone who has, you know, chosen and put themselves out there as a public figure. So it's really hard. I would have been shocked if, you know, this had gone the other way.
Okay. Now, from the right to speak up to the right to light up, Kathleen Ronayne, you've been covering the medical marijuana issue as it's developed in the State House over the years. Now, there are dispensaries who have won approval from the state regulators to set up shop. Is there going to be access to medical marijuana anytime soon in the state of New Hampshire?
Well, I'm hesitant to ever put a timeline on anything that is going to be happening in the state of New Hampshire with our state government. But, you know, the Department of Health and Human Services has put their own timeline on it. They're saying this is going to be at least 8 to 9 months, we think, before this first dispensary is open. And once you get 8 to 9 months out, that's nearly 3 years after the state passed its medical marijuana law, made the policy decision that, you know, we believe that people who meet these conditions and have approval from their doctors should be able to use medical marijuana. So while it does mark a significant step forward in the process, there's still a lot of frustration about many of the delays that have come down. You know, the way the law was written, at least two dispensaries should have been licensed 18 months after the law passed, which would have been in January. So we're already quite a ways past that. These dispensaries have to win local approval. They have to actually begin building. They have to begin growing the marijuana that they're going to be that they're going to be giving to people. So I think we're a long ways out. And what's been interesting to me is that one of the biggest frustrations among advocates for this is that until these dispensaries are up and running, there's no legal protection for someone in New Hampshire who wants to use medical marijuana.
So they couldn't go across the border to Maine, which already has a system up and running, and
buy the marijuana, come back, and if they're caught with it, you know, they could be arrested. And the way the law was intended from the sponsors was that people would be able to obtain identification cards that said, you know, my doctor has given me permission. I qualify under the law for this, that would protect them if they had marijuana from somewhere else. In 2014, the AG's office said, our interpretation is that you can't get an ID card until you have a legal place to get the marijuana. So no ID cards until the dispensaries come online. And, you know, there actually have been some cases. The Valley News wrote a story in May about a man up in Lebanon who I think essentially the police were walking through his apartment building responding to another call, and they smelled some marijuana, go into his apartment. He has a license from the state of Washington, where he recently moved from, has a small bit of marijuana. They arrest him. So, you know, this is – that's – I don't know how often that's happening, but that's something that advocates for this are pointing to. So it's just, you know, definitely a positive step forward for people looking to this law. But I think there are real frustrations that it's 2 years later after, you know, we've made the decision as a state that we support this. And there's still no access to it.
Trent Spinner.
Another potential kink in the timeline is that there are that these facilities have to be built, and towns and cities have to decide where they want them, what they're going to look like, what sort of hours of operation they're going to have. And that's a process that has to go through probably selectmen, planning board, zoning board, all of that. And that can take some more time.
Well, and who does the growing? Is that contracted out as it is in the state of Maine? There are people who get licenses as growers, and they supply the medical facilities.
Well, this whole situation we're discussing is the reason why supporters of medical marijuana in the state pushed for a grow your own option so that precise – I remember the arguments precisely for this reason. The concern was you have people who are suffering who need it now. If you're going to conceptually approve the idea, they should be able to grow their own while you're waiting for these dispensaries to be up and running. And as Kathleen said, it's going to end up being, you know, roughly 3 years by the time they actually get it.
Well, so we're waiting for that to develop, and it's going to be some time. Three companies, some with experience in other states, to operate four different dispensaries around the state. But those who feel like they need this this medicine are just going to have to wait. It's the bottom line. So, now we're here in the end of the show. Often when we look at presidential primary politics in the state of New Hampshire, since the last show, there have been a few visits. The first one from Vermont Democratic Socialist Bernie Sanders, since he formally announced. He made a visit to Keene, fairly friendly territory, I think, liberal side of the things, close to Vermont. What kind of impression is Sanders making in New Hampshire now that he's an official candidate?
You know, I think it's pretty incredible. I haven't actually seen him in person, but from the reporters who I've talked to who have been out there, they've said it's pretty incredible to see how many people are showing up. They weren't sure how many people would show up. And, you know, sometimes these house parties might have a dozen people or whatever, you know, not for Bernie Sanders, but there are hundreds of people showing up for Bernie Sanders, people who are riding their bikes there and coming from all over the state to see him. So, you know, I think this is going to be interesting.
The Sentinel counted, I think, 1,000 people at this Keene event. Kathleen Ronayne.
Yeah, I think that Bernie Sanders certainly knows how to fire up a crowd. You know, I saw him at a house party, which certainly wasn't 1,000 people, but there were – he was standing in the living room. You know, all the furniture is moved. The windows are open. And there are people outside on the lawn because they can't fit in the house, and they really want to hear what he has to say, and they're clapping and cheering. And I think it's going to be really interesting. We're going to see this weekend Hillary Clinton is going to do her first big rally of her campaign. So is she able to, you know, inflect that same kind of passion and get that same kind of, you know, we know that she has a lot of supporters out there. But so far, we haven't seen her this time around in a setting where she's really talking to a big crowd and trying to rile them up. And if it doesn't go well, and if they're able to make a real contrast with Bernie Sanders, I think that kind of only elevates Bernie. And she'll be back, you know, in New Hampshire on Monday. So it'll be interesting to kind of watch the contrast between the two of them, because he's very, very good at getting a crowd going and cheering.
But, you know, so far this has been of the Clinton campaign's own doing, because they made a decision to have these small, controlled, invitation-only panels in her few visits to the state so far. We'll see how that big rally goes. You know, Fred, it's pretty clear that Bernie has become kind of a vessel for all the progressives who are unhappy with the idea of a Hillary Clinton nomination, or at least want some way to kind of pressure her to move her to the left a little bit.
Warren has hung up its hat, right?
The
group trying to get Elizabeth Warren to
run
has hung up its hat.
Right. They decided that it's pretty clear she's not going to run. So, you know, and Martin O'Malley is sort of trying to make a pitch for progressives as well. He seems to be the most logical competition for Bernie Sanders. But, you know, Bernie Sanders enjoys a lot of advantages up here, given the proximity. And you were talking about the western part of the state, sort of very Vermontish and kind of very progressive. And he's also doing well out in Iowa. He's drawing pretty big crowds out in Iowa. So it'll provide a nice contrast for the Clinton campaign. But, you you know, we'll see. I think if they start loosening the reins a little bit, she might get a little more excitement and some bigger crowds as well.
Trent Spinner, do you think that that Bernie Sanders is sweeping Martin O'Malley aside here in New Hampshire?
No, I don't. And that's what I wanted to bring up, was that I think that you can't forget that Governor O'Malley, who will be here tomorrow and is opening an office and has a lot of New Hampshire people who are working for him. I think there's still I think there's still some potential there, and people are going to get to meet him. And I think that's happening. The other thing that's happening this weekend is really interesting. The folks from the Draft Joe Biden campaign are going to be in New Hampshire. The executive director is William Pierce, a Franklin Pierce grad who knows the state and has been in politics for the better part of a decade. And so, you know, we'll see how that goes.
Well, so a lot of fun to be had, I think, for pundits and reporters such as ourselves, and hopefully for the general public as well. We spoke earlier about Carly Fiorina and her problems with the way the Fox News debate in August may be stacking up, and the union leader's role in trying to create an alternative. A bit of tension within the Republican Party over that particular issue. We also have seen some disagreement that we talked about earlier around the budget and how to handle at least the optics around that within the state house and amongst the media. Then there's the question of Congressman Frank Ginta, who has admitted to the FEC that for violations of campaign finance rules. There seems to be a split within the party about whether he should resign or not, and whether he in fact is an honest player or not. We've seen some of the top brass, including Senator Ayotte and others, calling for his resignation. Just recently, the chairwoman of the state party, Jennifer Horn, came out very strongly calling for his resignation. Then the vice chairman of the same organization resigned over that. What's going on? Is there a real problem for the party over Frank Ginta?
What's going on is sort of business as usual for Frank Ginta. If you follow his social media posts, it's like nothing happened. He's posting photos of him going out to breakfast with his family,
fighting for a certain bill,
tweeting about I'm going to be on the House floor, the House approved, but he hasn't been doing interviews. We have not been able to talk to him. We've asked. And yes, there was a split in the party, but I think that split has become less of a split with Jennifer Horn's letter. There are a lot of people who say he should be gone and that this is going to cause major problems for us in the next election. But on his end of things, it's business as usual.
Well, Kathleen Ronayne, why shouldn't he just dig in and say, hey, I was legally elected and I'm going to keep on going and I'm even going to run again? Is he a liability for the party?
I would say that the longer this continues and the more potential there are for other things to come out or for, you know, the party to keep fighting with itself, I think that's only a bad thing for the New Hampshire Republican Party. I think that, you know, the more divided they seem, I think the easier it is for Democrats and others to, you know, just kind of drive those wedges further and further. And heading into 2016, you know, I think they are looking for some unity within the party. And I think that, you know, we'll see what happens. I mean, if this all just kind of does go away, then maybe it's not so bad. But especially if he tries to run again, then that's, you know, it's not just he's saying right now that he's going to run again. And then it's not just, you know, it's not just him that affects. It's everybody else who's possibly on the ticket with him. And I think we're seeing Democrats, you know, at every turn try to tie Kelly Ayotte to Frank Ginta. That is what they're doing. That's what they'll continue to do. And I think that, you know, the issue, as Jennifer Horn laid out in her letter to the executive committee, is really kind of about the perpetual lying that we've seen from Congressman Ginta, you know, continuing to put out these messages that evidence continues to show are just totally false. And so I think that that's where the frustration is among Republicans. You know, they don't want this huge weight around their ankle heading into 2016. But, you know, if you're Frank Ginta, you keep collecting your congressional salary and going along with your business. It's going to be fascinating to me to see, does he really try to run in 2016?
Dean Spiliotis, just one word answer. Do you think he can hang on? He lost a staffer this week. Does it eventually become too much for him?
A couple words. I think he can. He'll probably he can hang on. I don't think he'll be the nominee in the next election.
Okay. Thank you, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, for joining us today. I'll note also that you're the author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Thank you, Trent Spinner, executive editor of the New Hampshire Union Leader, and Kathleen Ronayne, New Hampshire State House and politics reporter for the Associated Press. It's been great spending some time with you guys here at NHPR. This has been the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I've been Fred Bever, and still am Fred Bever, in for Laura Kanoy at the moment. I have a few credits that I want to be sure to read before we sign out. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producers are Faith Mikesell and Jason Moon. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Fred Bever, sitting in for Laura Kanoy. Thanks.